changes to our weekday evening programming, including our recent reworking of our Friday night schedule to introduce On the Media and the expanded one-hour edition of Left, Right, and Center. To make sure we're on the right track, we've created a quick four-question listener survey. Please take a moment to let us know what you think. Just look for the red survey box at the top of KALW.org. Thanks.
I'm Seth Posted. Join me as I welcome Q2 Music's Phil Klein into the studio to discuss and play new releases by a wide range of artists for the next in our ongoing Soundword collaboration. That's next time on Relevant Tones.
Relevant Tones concludes our musical evening on Monday. Tonight at 11, it's preceded by The Record Shelf with Jim Schweda. He'll be exploring music from Sigmund Romberg. And the Spoleto Chamber Music Festival start things off tonight at 9. All ahead here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco. Online at KALW.org.
Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Advocates for victims' rights and advocates for criminal justice reform are often posed at opposite ends of the political spectrum, with priorities at odds and at times in direct conflict. On the one hand, the tough-on-crime stance that is associated with the victims' rights movement supports incarceration, strict sentencing laws, and is wary of early release programs and crime prevention efforts. On the other, criminal justice reform advocates bring attention to race and class inequities in incarceration rates and sentencing, and focus on prisoners' rights, such as access to health care, appropriate legal representation, and concerns about prison overcrowding. These contrasting views played out on the national stage in 2011 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled 5-4 in favor of mandating that California reduce its prison population to reduce chronic overcrowding. With this mandate, California sprang into action and has made progress in prison population reductions without the increase in violent crimes feared by opponents. But one California organization did more than that. Californians for Safety and Justice started to bridge the divide between the victims' rights conversation and the criminal justice reform conversation by talking directly to crime survivors about their needs and found that they extended far beyond a desire for justice as defined by conviction and incarceration. Coincidentally, UCSF's Trauma Recovery Center right here in San Francisco began expanding the types of services it provided to its clients, survivors of violent crimes, to include those things that they said they wanted. Well, tonight we bring those two threads together in one conversation as we talk to two leaders from these organizations that have brought an innovative approach to bridging the gap between trauma and justice, and how their work and their vision meets the needs of those most impacted by crime, the survivors. Joining me tonight in the studio to discuss these questions and more are Dr. Alicia Basileri. She is the founder of the UCSF Trauma Recovery Center and its director of special programs and a mentor of mine. Welcome, Alicia.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And by phone, we are joined from Sacramento by Robert Rooks, vice president of the Alliance for Safety and Justice and the organizing director of Californians for Safety and Justice. Welcome, Robert.
Thank you so much. Good to be here as well.
Great. And later on in the program, we'll be joined by Dion Wilson. She's a national survivor advocate for Alliance for Safety and Justice. And of course, we invite you, our listeners, to join in our conversation. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes. I'll give you that phone number now. It's 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment at the KALW website. You can tweet us at City Visions, KLW. We also have a Facebook page. Lots of ways for you to get connected with our conversation tonight. So I wanted to start with you, Alicia Basileri, here in the studio with me in San Francisco. Tell us a little bit about the Trauma Recovery Center and what it does and how it came to be and what kind of gap was it trying to fill when it came to the needs of survivors of violent crimes?
Well, I've been a psychologist at San Francisco General for a long time, and going back, about 20 years ago, the head of surgery, Dr. Bill Schechter, made a comment to me, and the comment was, we can sew them up, but we can't make them well. And what I think he was getting at was that San Francisco General is a level one trauma center, which means all of the major injuries, severe injuries, end up at San Francisco General. And the surgeon was lamenting the fact that even though medical intervention was intervening and saving lives, he was finding that on medical follow-up, these people were not doing so well. And it got me to thinking about what was missing. And what I realized at that point was that San Francisco General was doing, in fact, a great job. We were seeing victims of gun violence and victims of assault, and physically they were healing. And we would oftentimes give them a referral to the local mental health system, and we would hope that they would make their way there. And Dr. Schechter's statement to me, I guess in some ways, galvanized me and some other people in the Department of Psychiatry to look into the issue of what ended up happening with these victims. And what we ended up finding was that many of them ended up, even though they were in the throes of post-traumatic stress disorder, many of them, in fact, were not getting the kinds of mental health treatment that they needed. And so that began us on what has turned out to be a 20-year journey, looking at what were those gaps and how we could help them.
And why weren't they getting the services that they needed?
I think that there are many reasons for that. First of all, while violent crime can happen to any of us, a lot of times the people that are most affected are people living in poor communities, people of color. And I think particularly for that community, there's a lot of issues, a lot of barriers that stand in the way. For example, and this isn't true just of people living in poor communities, but when you think about, we keep on hearing about post-traumatic stress disorder. Probably a day doesn't go by when we don't hear about another mass shooting or some kind of violence. And so I think we're all very familiar with the term post-traumatic stress disorder. But one of the things I think people don't realize is that when people are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, they often want to avoid talking about what happened to them because talking about it helps makes them relive the experience. And so I think post-traumatic stress disorder pushes people into avoidance mode. And yet, without talking about it, many people cannot start on the journey toward healing. I think that's one issue. The next issue is a lot of people are very skeptical of mental health services. And, you know, I could go and introduce myself and say, I'm a psychologist. Is there some way I can help you? And the first response I will get is, I'm not crazy. And so I think there is a huge stigma around people receiving mental health services, that there's a lot of distrust around receiving mental health services. And I think this is particularly true in poor communities. I think part of it is traditional mental health providers. I think we're to blame for some of that. I think we haven't done enough to make people feel comfortable talking about their experiences. And oftentimes people feel judged by us. And so we realized that in order to bridge that gap, we needed to do something different.
And so what did that turn out to be?
Well, so when we first began, we thought what we would do, we would approach people at their bedside at San Francisco General when they were recovering from their injuries. And we thought all we needed to do was to say, we have mental health services for you, and that they would gladly sign up for those services. And we were very mistaken by that because, again, many of them were wanting to avoid treatment. And one of the things we realized was that people with post-traumatic stress disorder are often so overwhelmed by their symptoms that they also need a lot of practical assistance. So instead of immediately jumping in and saying, we have mental health services for you, we began asking them, what did they need help with? We found that they needed help getting safe housing. They needed help filing police reports. They needed help getting other kinds of entitlements. And so we began offering them a lot of wraparound case management services, which included doing home visits, taking them to appointments. And along the way, when trust developed, they began to feel more comfortable so that they were able to, at that point, receive mental health services.
So basically, you went in with a hunch. Your first attempts to address what you thought the needs were met with resistance.
We failed.
And then you pulled back and said, well, tell us, what do you really need? And then that's kind of how things got rolling.
Exactly. And again, it's just so humbling to realize that a lot of times all it really takes is slowing down and listening to the people we work with, because they really are the experts on their own life, and they usually are the experts on what it is they need. And so I think it's a humbling experience, and one of the core tenets of the Trauma Recovery Center model is trying to meet people where they are.
Hmm. So Robert Rooks, Organizing Director of Californians for Safety and Justice and Vice President of the Alliance for Safety and Justice, tell us about your organization and specifically how you came to this very similar realization that Alicia did, which is that in order to understand what people need, you have to give them the space in the room to tell you that. But specifically in this case, you went, you know, perhaps she was there to serve these victims of violent crime. You weren't necessarily, that wasn't your necessarily what you were after. You're on the side of criminal justice reform. How did you think right. to reach out to the victims of violent crime? What was your journey?
Well, first of all, thank you for creating this space and allowing for Dr. Bacciolari to share the amazing story of the Trauma Recovery Center. Since the first time we met, I was just in awe of her work and excited to be in partnership with her. So thank you for that. The California for Safety and Justice was founded back in 2012, right after the Plata case, which was the case that required the state of California to reduce incarceration within 5 years. And we were founded to help the state with that, to develop strategies and campaigns and policy solutions for prison reduction. But in our analysis early on, in looking at the landscape, we realized something glaring. And that was that there are two sides of the debate, right? There were, and I think you framed it quite well at the beginning, there were the law enforcement side, right, advocating for tough policies, same policies we've seen in the last 20 or so years. And then there were civil liberties and civil rights side, right, talking about racial justice, talking about the need to reduce incarceration. And we, in our thinking, saw the need to bridge. Right, we saw the need to elevate a very important piece in both sides, and that is community safety. Right, where are we as a society? Right, how are we accomplishing real public safety? And in that analysis, we were able to pull law enforcement and pull civil liberties and pull advocates in the middle and teachers and labor all with us. To lay out a platform for safety and justice in the state of California. And what was central to that strategy was listening to, talking to, working with people that was most impacted by crime and violence and people that experienced crime and violence on a daily basis. And those were crime victims. These were people whose voices were ignored. These were people who were not part of policy-making discussions around criminal justice. They were not asked over the last 20 or 30 years what did they want to see in the justice system. They did not co-sign on expanding prisons and these one-size-fits-all solutions to crime and violence. They didn't sign on to decrease investments in schools and treatment and increase investments in prisons. They were just going, living their lives, managing and dealing with the issues and challenges as relates to their experiences, and we thought it would be best to talk to them, right? And
let me pause you there for just a moment. Why weren't survivors consulted? before you started doing so? What do you think was made that be?
So I think it speaks to the earlier point Dr. Bacellari raised around race and how race shows up in our work, right? There is a survivor constituency that has a pretty loud voice, but that survivor constituency did not represent survivors that were experiencing crime and violence on a daily basis, specifically issues as it relates to community trauma, community violence, and gun violence, and those types of issues. The people that experienced those things were marginalized, and so race is a huge factor in all of it, and who was listened to and who wasn't, and therefore the policies that emerged obviously were policies that negatively impacted communities of color, in particular black and brown communities, and that's why we see mass incarceration. And so our organization felt to make an important bridge and to elevate the issue of safety, we needed to talk to people about what made them safe, about what they wanted out of the justice system, about what was and what wasn't being addressed. And we learned three things. We learned, one, that crime survivors want what happened to them not to happen to them again. Two, crime survivors want what happened to them not to happen to others. And three, crime survivors want help and healing for their community. And so after a series of conversations throughout the state of California, we laid out a platform. We laid out a platform that sought to divest in the prison system and invest in programs to help people heal. And that strategy was identified, led by, guided by victims of crime, people of color who experience crime and violence on a daily basis, as well as their allies.
So this is a point that you kind of said very quickly, and I want to make sure to pause on it for a second, which is that survivors that you talked to wanted help and healing not just for themselves, but they're for their community. And when you say community, do you include the people who committed the crimes against them?
Well, what we learned pretty early on is that it's a false dichotomy that we created. Between people that have committed crimes and the people that have committed crimes against them. You know, people are dynamic. People live, long lives and do many things in between. And in some cases, people are victims of crime. In some cases, people may have committed crime. And what we learn is that unaddressed trauma, right, was what was not being dealt with appropriately in communities. And so when we talked about trauma, we talked about the fact, and I believe Dr. Bacellari's Speakers Bureau say this very eloquently, hurt people hurt people, right? Like, if we don't begin to get at the root causes of crime and focus on stopping the cycles of crime and looking at the role of trauma in that, then we're totally missing the point. So we don't buy into this dichotomy of people that have committed versus people that were victims of crime. We believe that we need to get to the root causes and stop the cycle.
So it sounds like the convergence point between victims of violent crime and those who commit them is a shared trauma, whether it's on their individual in their individual lives or in some sort of more communal or collective way. Would you say that? Is that a fair summary of what you're trying to say?
I would, but there's also a political point I'm trying to say as well, which is we were fed a particular false choice for 25 years, right? People that committed crime are bad, and we need to throw them away and lock away the key. And we as a society didn't really look at what happened before the person committed the crime, right? We're like, what happened in their lives? And if we can begin to address that as a society, then we would then, in fact, break the cycle of crime.
And one more question before I go back to Alicia. How widespread is this conceptualization that when it comes to criminal justice reform and victims' rights, that it's really a continuum. It's a conversation on a continuum. And is it specific to the communities that you work with? You mentioned, both of you mentioned poor communities, communities of color. Is this something that's specific? Does it branch out beyond that? How widespread is this notion that we've been making the wrong choice all these years?
Well, I believe it's a concept that resonates throughout the state of California. And the reason why I say that is because in the 70s, community colleges used to be free. We have, instead of building out and investing in our education system, we built 22 prisons and one university during a 30-year time period, right? We have made misplaced investments with misplaced priorities all throughout the state of California, and everyone is feeling it. And what we would say is, if we were to just focus on, right, the cycle of crime and stopping the cycle of crime, as opposed to just throwing a cell block at every solution, draining resources from important public sector investments, then we would be in a better place today. And so, therefore, that's our direction for the future, is that we need to invest in those things that make communities safer, and that's good schools, right? That's good jobs. That's support for trauma. That's mental health and substance abuse investments. And those are things that all Californians care about. And
I want to reintroduce the program in case you're just joining us. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache. And tonight we're discussing innovative approaches to bringing together the conversations about victims' rights and criminal justice reform with two leaders in these respective areas. Dr. Alicia Basileri, founder of the UCSF Trauma Recovery Center and its director of special programs, here in the studio with me. And on the phone, Robert Rooks, joining us from Sacramento, Organizing Director of Californians for Safety and Justice and Vice President of the Alliance for Safety and Justice. We invite you to call in with your questions and comments for our guests. The number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, tweet us at cityvisionsKALW, or post a comment at our Facebook page. So, Dr. Basileri, Alicia, I wanted to get back to this notion of sort of community-level trauma. Tell us, you know, a lot of your work is on an individual one-on-one basis, but how does the Trauma Recovery Center understand this more widespread shared experience that feeds into this cycle of crime?
Well, you know, I just want to reflect on something that Robert said, and I think we need to get to the root causes of violence and recognizing that violence and poverty go hand in hand. And when you're working with adults, victims of trauma, as we do at the Trauma Recovery Center, and we begin asking people about their lives, one of the things we find is that by the time people come to us at the Trauma Recovery Center, they may have been brought in recently because they've been a victim of crime, but the average person we see at the TRC, the average person has a history of 5 or 6 violent crimes that have happened to them before they even step foot at the TRC. And we begin looking at that, and we see that they've grown up in poverty, they've witnessed street violence, they've witnessed domestic violence, childhood physical abuse, childhood emotional abuse. And so people are coming to us, and it's really true what Robert says, hurt people hurt people. So I think unless we really begin getting to the root causes of that, I think we're a little bit stuck. And I love the work that I'm doing, and I do believe we make a difference in people's lives. But I have to say, we have to do better than just patching people up. The approach that when I first met Robert and he told me about what he was doing, for me, it was like all the lights went off for me. It was, can you imagine if we can begin developing safe communities and healthy communities, what that would look like. And what that would look like would be to really try to eliminate racism and for really mental health to embrace the idea of social justice. So that's how Robert and I got together on this, was I think we were both looking for similar things, and I think the work he is doing gives me some hope that maybe we can begin getting to the root causes of some of this.
And how do you bring that social justice lens into the work you do with individuals?
Oh, so that's a really good question. And again, I think we continue, I think every single day, I think I continue to learn something new. But, you know, there's the concept of cultural humility, and that's the appreciation that, you know, we, first of all, I'm a white woman. I come from a position of white privilege. And to me, that means that when I'm sitting in a room with someone, an African-American woman whose son has been murdered, that I need to slow down a little bit and I need to really hear about her experience. That I may have all the education, I may have a PhD, I may be a psychologist, but that I really cannot really speak to what she has lived through. And that in some ways we're a collaborative partnership where I end up learning a lot from her as well. So it is, when we talk about, I think we need to bring these issues into the room with us. I think we need to ask our clients, you know, what does it feel like? What do you think about is going to happen in mental health treatment? What are some of your fears? What are some of your worries? I think we need to put it out there for people to talk about their concerns, to talk about, are they afraid that I'm going to judge them somehow? And there needs to be a way of kind of making it a more, as much as we can, a less judgmental process. And I think through that, we need to highlight issues of social justice. I can't tell you how many of the moms that I work with who have lost sons to gun violence, even before we had the slogan, Black Lives Matter, I was hearing for many years from my black clients that they did not feel when their son was murdered because they were black or brown, that the community really felt that their lives mattered as much as a white person who might have also been injured or killed. And so, again, I think if we don't bring this up in our therapy, our clients are not going to feel comfortable talking about it. And I think that's the role that racism oftentimes plays a part in mental health treatment, is when the mental health therapist is not open to talking about issues of social justice.
So it's allowing that into the conversation, having the larger social issues come into the conversation, into the therapy.
Yes.
So back to you, Robert Rooks. So you gathered in 2013, you gathered perspectives from victims of violent crime in terms of what kinds of services they needed, what their perspectives were on what they thought criminal justice, the aim of criminal justice should be. What things that you mentioned a lot about what their perspectives were, but what were some surprising perspectives, even to someone like you who kind of knew that we were getting it wrong and we needed to take a different tack?
I think the statistic that it doesn't surprise me, but one that I think is important for your listeners to know about is how 2/3 of crime victims believe that we're wasteful in terms of our investments in prisons, and that we need to invest more in rehabilitation and treatment. And so it was that data point that really helped frame an agenda for us, that we were moving in the wrong direction and we need to focus more on getting real resources into the community to help people heal. And that crime victims, and later we found out the public, no longer believed in in prisons as a vehicle for making us safe.
And what was it about their experience or experiences that led them to have this point of view that others didn't immediately share, but maybe later on kind of realized was something that we needed to ponder more?
I think after 30 years of a failed policy, people began looking at the complexity of the issue. And anytime government or anyone sells you a silver bullet, this is the one thing that will help, that will make matters problems go away. You learn that that's just not true over time. And so,
especially if they continue to be victims of violent crime, I imagine.
Well, that's what I was going to go to next. Right? Was that what crime victims began experiencing from the justice system was, one, they were not being heard in the process. So when they would make recommendations for what should happen to the person that committed the crime against them, those recommendations were not being listened to and adhered to. Two, when people would come out of the justice system, they were not coming out, any better than when they went in. In a lot of instances, where was the real investments for helping people going? Three, when people were taken out of the community that they live, there were less resources in those communities. There's less tax dollars regarding work going in. There's fathers that aren't able to father their children. Mothers aren't able to mother their children. And so crime victims started to see from a lot of different angles that the justice system wasn't working. And then begin having their own ideas of what should happen. And so what we also found was this emergence of grassroots groups on the ground, right, taking the issue into their own hands, right? The groups would emerge that would help people get to treatment facilities and support. First responders would come and negotiate regarding violence prevention. There is, and there has been for the last decade or so, just these emergence of grassroots groups that has been working to address some of these issues that the criminal justice system is just missing.
Again, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing innovative approaches to criminal justice reform through the voice of survivors of violent crime. We're joined in the studio here by Dr. Alicia Bossolari, founder of the UCSF Trauma Recovery Center and its director of special programs. On the phone from Sacramento is Robert Rooks, organizing director of Californians for Safety and Justice and vice president of the Alliance for Safety and Justice. We invite you to call in with your questions and comments. The number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. What do you think about this convergence of the criminal justice reform movement and the victims' rights movement in trying to change the way that we look at the root causes of violent crime and the solutions to reducing crime in our communities? 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org, post a comment on our website, or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. So now I want to bring in another guest, Dionne Wilson. She is a national survivor advocate for the Alliance for Safety and Justice. Dionne, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So tell us a little bit about yourself and the work that you do for this organization.
Well, unlike my colleagues on the line, I didn't really come to this work through training or, any type of purposeful uh, I'm sorry. I've got some background noise here. I'm really sorry. I came to this through my experience of losing my husband. He was a police officer working in the city of San Leandro, and in 2005 he was murdered in the line of duty. And coming from that background, being a police wife, I definitely had certain opinions about crime and who committed crime and who was in prison and that they should stay there. And I really, I didn't have any analysis or real perspective about what the drivers of crime were or how to stop it. In 2007, Irving Ramirez was convicted of my husband's murder and sent to death row. And I thought, well, I got my justice, and there it is. Now I can start feeling better. Now I can heal and move forward with my life. But it didn't actually happen that way, and it didn't make me feel better. And I just really struggled to find something positive to do with this tragedy, because my husband loves serving the community, and I wanted something positive to come out of this, and I just had no idea what to do with it. And I, you know, unlike people that the trauma recovery centers serve, I got every service I needed. I got all the money I needed. I got all the counseling and therapy. I had support. I had everything. And I just thought that was normal. I thought that's what happened when somebody was a victim of crime. I had no idea what it's like for people that struggle with repeat victimization in communities that are impacted by violence. And when I met Robert, and he told me about the work they were doing, and it just seemed like the right thing to do is to really look at the true drivers of crime and try to find a way to get ahead of that. Because like both of them said, our policies over the last 30 to 35 years have failed. They failed every community. They failed me and my family and my husband. I mean, our policies clearly have not made us safer. And so I wanted to be a part of something that was actually trying to accomplish that.
So you said this pretty eloquently, that despite the access to multiple services and supports, you felt that something was missing for you, that you weren't made whole by mm-hmm. The conviction and the sentencing of the person who killed your husband.
Right.
Can you say more about what exactly was missing and what your involvement with this work as a survivor advocate for a criminal justice reform organization, what has that provided you?
Well, I think the piece that was missing was how was that conviction alone going to prevent something like this from happening to the next police family? How was that going to make the communities that police go into, in order to serve those communities and protect the people that live there, how is Irving being incarcerated going to improve public safety? And I had to really pull back and analyze that whole situation, and I came to my own conclusion that it really isn't solving the larger issue. It that part of it was missing. I needed to feel like, okay, this isn't, my family didn't go through this. I didn't go through this tragedy for nothing. And so what Californians for Safety and Justice has done for me, and now Alliance for Safety and Justice, and the Nationwide Project, what that's done for me is allowed me to influence policies that I believe will truly improve public safety. It's not just when people say criminal justice reform, there tends to be this thing where there's a perception that we're just on the side of incarcerated people and getting them, all of these privileges and rights when they're incarcerated. That's really not it for me. For me, really, it is making it so when people do get incarcerated, they come out better. They come out healed. They come out actually understanding what accountability looks like. Because incarceration does not automatically equal accountability. And so I wanted to be involved in an organization that was actually doing something to increase public safety. And I believe that when people come home from prison or jail and they've had the opportunity to do some internal work, then they come home and they're allowed to again participate in society, that makes us all safer. And the fact that people who live in high crime communities are often the most underserved and the most likely to be repeat victims of violent crime. And so if we're not addressing the things that happen within those communities, we're again ignoring the thing that can increase public safety.
I wonder if you would share, if it's okay for you to do so, how your perspective towards the person who killed your husband may have shifted from, the early period right after his death to today.
Well, I think that the most profound shift I've had really is a broader understanding of what drives people to be stuck in a cycle of violence. And it's been a very long and difficult journey, trying to come to terms with how unproductive my anger and my hatred was, and focusing that energy into something that extends beyond me and the impact it had on me, and how I can use this experience to advocate for policies that just make us safer and make us better as a society.
And how about your family members or your husband's colleagues? How do they approach your approach to this? What's their reaction to this stance that you've taken?
Well, if they don't talk to me about it and they don't understand why I'm doing what I'm doing, then they can kind of invent their own narrative around it. And sometimes that isn't always positive, and it's definitely not accurate. If they actually take the time to talk to me about it and listen to why I am on the side of justice reform and why I want things to change, then they totally get it. And the people that are close to me are absolutely supportive, and I haven't really had any pushback from people who know me, but really the point I really want to make is that these services that the Trauma Recovery Center is providing to people in the communities that need it the most, I thought this was normal. And that whole, that evolution of me figuring out that, well, no, it's not normal. When I started talking to people who were repeat victims of violent crime from highly impacted neighborhoods, they didn't get anything. And that realization was horrifying to me, because I just didn't realize the lack of services and the enormous need there is, this ginormous void that Dr. Bottolieri has worked so hard to fill. And it's just, it's something that needs to be in the minds of everybody in California and nationwide. This is a vital service that we need in all of our communities.
Thank you, Dion, for sharing so much of your personal experience on this. I'm going to have you hang on the line. That was Dion Wilson, National Survivor Advocate for the Alliance for Safety and Justice. Her husband, a police officer, was killed in the line of duty, and she's just described to us how she has become an advocate for criminal justice reform through the experiences she's had since that occurred. So, Alicia Bottolieri, I wanted to turn to you. When you hear Dion's story, there was a line in there somewhere where she said that she, you know, she talked about her hatred, and then in the next breath, it was about healing. How do you understand the shift that happened to her, that can happen to others, and how that could be really important in supporting victims and survivors of violent crime?
Well, first, I just want to acknowledge Dion, and just to recognize just how much courage it takes to speak out publicly on one's personal experience, especially the death of a spouse. And, you know, I think, to me, it always gives me, when I've heard Dion speak and I've heard my clients speak, it gives me a sense of hope. Because I think people are basically resilient, and I think that many people can move from a place of anger and a place of vengeance to maybe not forgiveness, and that's not certainly something that a lot of people can experience. But I do feel that a lot of times that people can end up becoming very resilient in the face of violence and can use the trauma that has happened to them as a jumping off point to give back to the community. And at the Trauma Recovery Center, we have developed with our clients CHAT, which stands for Communities Healing and Transforming Trauma. And CHAT is a speakers bureau, and what we find is that a lot of our clients really do have a desire to give back to the community. And so they end up, we work with them where they go into the community and they do public speaking, where they're able to transform, use their experience to educate others about violence. And by doing so, I think it ends up very much helping in the healing experience.
And Robert Rooks, listening to someone like Dion speak, it's quite powerful. Tell us about how, despite maybe the impact of those words, that your organization may be still fighting obstacles to get people to broaden their perspective, to question the conventional wisdom around what victims' rights should be about and what criminal justice should be about.
No, absolutely. It continues to be a struggle. And, you know, the reality we live in today, where we have 2.2 million people incarcerated, in this country, you know, was built over a long period of time, right? It's become an industry, right? That there are, you know, one out of every eight public employee in this country works for the justice system. That's just a reality. And so when we have these conversations, it's hard for some to have the conversation without thinking that this is about a job or a career or, you know, it's not. This is about safety. And you know, we want more people to be employed to keep our community safe. We want more people to be employed, to be public health workers, to be social service workers, to be mental health counselors. We need more investments in communities, not less. And so we're just going to continue to center safety in the conversation, continue to listen. Our North Star are folks like Dion and others who have been courageous in stepping up and laying out what works for them and what they want to see out of the justice system. That's our North Star in our organization, and we'll continue to be guided by that. And we'll continue to have the fight very publicly about what works and what doesn't work. So, yes, you're absolutely correct. The fight continues, but, you know, when you have programs like the Trauma Recovery Center and the work of Dr. Bacellari, and it's evidence-based. I mean, Dr. Bacellari can pull out data to show, you know, how her program not only helps people individually, but also goes a long way in terms of increasing relationship between the community and law enforcement. It goes a long way in terms of violence reduction. And so we can talk about how evidence-based programming is a much better investment per dollar than the one-size-fits-all solutions of the past of incarceration.
And so what kind of arguments, when you have someone as eloquent and courageous as Dion speaking, what kind of arguments do you hear in terms of pushback from those who have a more traditional point of view on victims' rights, a more traditional tough-on-crime, law-and-order perspective? What's their rebuttal?
Well, you know, people have different experiences, right? I mean, our organization and our work is not about us being the only voice, right, and the only group that has the solution. It's about diversity, right? It's about diversity of voices and putting forth evidence-based solutions that work. And so there are people that argue that that there's this distinction between hardened criminal and a victim, and lock them up and throw away the keys. That people continue to argue that point, long sentences and harsh sentences is the pathway to safety. That the folks that argue for the last 30 years are still around, and we have seen most recently from the administration increased rhetoric, right, around tough on crime, from targeting marijuana, which is something that we thought was a settled issue for the most part, and now is reemerging as public enemy number one for the administration. So those people are still around, and those people are using the same playbook that they used the last 30 years. We're just going to continue to talk about safety, center the voices, center programs like Dr. Bacellari, and continue to move this agenda forward.
Hmm. How has Prop 47 and the implementation of Prop 47 and helped you, helped prove your point?
Well, if you look at we have seen increased investments in trauma recovery centers. When we first started this work, there was one. There was the San Francisco Trauma Recovery Center. I believe the most recent tally, there are nine throughout the state. Am I right, Dr. Barcelona?
There's actually 11 now.
There are 11 now. I'm sorry, I'm doing less work in California, more nationally. So there are 11 trauma recovery centers throughout the state. We've also seen increased investments in mental health substance abuse programs. We've seen increased investments in K-12 programming to help address problems with high-risk young people. So having that infrastructure is huge. What we've also have not seen, which is what Tough on Crime people said that we would see, is a spike in crime. We, you know, all throughout the state, the crime is still at an all-time low. We've seen some moderate spikes in L.A., but that has a lot to do with, you know, how L.A. is currently managing this problem. We don't see the same spikes or problems with low-level arrests. We don't see the same spikes in large counties like San Diego, San Jose, and others. And so it's uniquely an L.A. problem. So with crime rate staying at an all-time low, with increased investments going out to mental health substance abuse programming, and a dramatic decrease in the prison population. I mean, when we first started 2012, I think there were somewhere around 170,000+ people in the California prisons. Now I think we're hovering around 124. With the passage of Prop 57, we'll see significant a more decrease, and for crime rates continue to be all-time low. We're proving the point. We're proving the point that we had made misplaced and wrong investments last 30 years, that if we just make the right investments today, then we can experience both reduced incarceration and public safety.
So what's next for the for your organization? So what's your next strategy here? What's your the next thing you're hoping to achieve?
Well, we want to continue to listen to the voices of crime victims as they talk about their experiences. There are still significant barriers for crime victims to get very basic services after experiencing a crime. So there's a lot more work to do there. Victim compensation continues to be a challenge. So that's one body of work that's tremendously important. We also, because of Proposition 47, we learned a lot about barriers to employment regarding formerly justice-involved people, people that have felonies on their records, that have held these felonies for decades, that have been barred out of licensing. Like, there's over 4,800 different licenses that people are barred from for having a felony on their record. So Prop 47 helped with that, but it also showed that there's way more work to do. That if we really want to center safety, then we have to eliminate barriers to employment and licensing to allow people to get back to work. So those are just two important ideas that we're going to continue to develop while we center a shared safety agenda. And we're looking for partners. We're looking for law enforcement that understand that they can't arrest their way out of this. It's just not going to happen. It's not possible. And so law enforcement that want to bring in other stakeholders in addition to law enforcement, from social services, from teachers, from employment services, from labor. But we all can sit together and plan on how we continue to build up infrastructures that will support people as opposed to incarcerate people. So we're going to move forward to shared safety agenda in the state.
And Dr. Bacalera, you get the last word. How does the mental health community really join in this effort in an elevated way to really look at the social justice aspect of this in a broader way outside of the session, the one-on-one session?
You know, I think, again, for me, just partnering up with a group like the Alliance for Safety and Justice, I think helps elevate the issue, where it's not just something that happens between a mental health clinician and a patient, but it really does expand the scope of what mental health people can get involved in. I really believe that violence has a ripple effect in the community, but I also feel that helping people heal also has a ripple effect, and it does make for healthier communities.
Well, I want to thank my guests this evening, Dr. Alicia Bossolari, founder of the UCSF Trauma Recovery Center and its director of special programs, Robert Rooks, organizing director of the Californians for Safety and Justice and vice president of the Alliance for Safety and Justice, and Dion Wilson, national survivor advocate for the Alliance for Safety and Justice. Thanks to all for you, for joining me this evening. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Judith Sansone. We're taking next Monday off for Labor Day. Join my co-host Ethan Elkind in 2 weeks when he sits down with actor, writer, director, and Berkeley resident Matt Ross. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.
This is 91.7 KALW San Francisco.
Over the weekend, large groups of mostly peaceful citizens took to the streets of San Francisco and Berkeley to stand up to hate and racism. There's a debate raging across the country about these issues. Last night at the MTV Video Awards, Reverend Robert Wright Lee